chapter 6 takes us into social development. We're going to skip back a couple chapters here. So, with respect, we've talked a little bit about child development with respect to issues of theory of mind, and we see there's some very interesting things happening in the first 5 years of life. In this sense, after about 5 years of age, you've got humans that have all of the sort of adult capacity there in terms of the particulars, the actual processes. People get better at it with experience. Learning is massively important for us as species and as individuals within that species. But at least by about age five, in terms of being able to interact socially with other members of our species, we got all the kind of hardware up and running that you need, dealing with what we'll call normal individuals there. So we've got this progression up over the first few years to full theory of mind, and you get better. You get better at this. Different people get better at different rates in terms of this. I know 50-year-old adults that still get, a very hard time figuring out when someone is lying to them. You know, the old, if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. No, this is real. Yeah. So, there's differences there. Now, we know that there are a certain number of genes, actually probably a lot of them, interacting in undoubtedly rather complicated ways that drive the developmental progression through stages. But it's not just the genes. There's environmental factors that come into play here as well. So we've got an interaction, complicated one going on. And, of course, the more complicated the social environment is, the more difficult this all, the more difficult to sort of reduce it down to individual components from a scientific perspective, the more difficult that becomes. What we can say out of this is, and this is perhaps why traditionally in psychology, so much of developmental psychology has focused on the early years. Like, developmental psychology is really from birth to death. It's continuous developmental changes. But a lot of what this has gone into in the past is the early years. I mean, we don't have a Piagetian stage analysis for people that are over 60. Besides, retire, play some long bowling, slow down, die. How depressing. Most of this has happened with, there's other things happening as you pass 60. But the point is, it hasn't received as much attention. In fact, it's really only over about the last maybe 20, 25 years that developmental psychology and, in fact, many university and graduate programs have actually started doing developmental psychology programs, courses, research into the mid to later years. So there's definitely an issue here. And I think part of the reason may be that if we look at what happens over the first 15 years of a person's life, this is where so much of the social cognition development really occurs. And if we think about this in terms of what humans do, we are these massively, I'm going to say, political creatures. Not in the sense of formal governmental politics, but every time you're if you will, interacting with others in some sort of group setting, you're engaging in essence, politics. The promotion of certain goals or individuals, the manipulation, for better or worse, of others. That's essentially politics. Social hierarchy. We are extremely hierarchical animals. Primates, very hierarchical, and complicated hierarchies. We'll talk later about social hierarchies some more. So I think this may be part of the reason why so much of the developmental psychology focus has occurred in the early years. And this goes back in the 20th century. Nobody in the early 20th century is talking about this in terms of a strong evolutionary psychology approach or theory of mind approach. It just, whether you formalize it in sort of the modern way or not, it pretty quickly becomes self-evident. There's a lot of important stuff that happens early on here. So, we're going to talk for a little while here about issues of the early years of development. Childhood, shall we say. Now, I mean, we can quibble about when childhood ends, but we're not going to get into too many specifics. Different cultures have different ideas of when you progress from childhood to adulthood and whatnot. But what we can say here is that humans have a fairly extended period of, we'll call it childhood, before they really become fully reproductively capable. Especially if we compare it to other mammals, but even other primates. We've talked about this in terms of life history. Our life history is very drawn out. And so this raises a real question. What's the purpose of this from an evolutionary perspective if the name of the evolutionary game is differential reproductive success? And that's how you win, right? To, quote Charlie Sheen, duh, winning means greater differential reproductive success. Then having this very extended childhood that cuts into those reproductive years, how does that work? How is that, adaptive? And this becomes sort of the interesting challenge here for evolutionary theories with this. It has to come up with a way of getting down to our ultimate sort of level of explanation here and saying that somehow this ultimately actually leads to a greater differential reproductive success. And one possibility here is that the childhood actually prepares children to be more reproductively functional and capable adults. Now, of course, this gets tied up in all kinds of, why do we have a longer life history than chimpanzees? Well, complicated factors, right? Some of this goes back to physiology. We've talked about this in terms of bipedalism, pelvic girdle, head size, brain growth, early being born a bit early, and non-precocial. So we've got issues, certainly we have issues there. The complexity of our brain and social cognition and social structures, Machiavellian intelligence, the higher levels of theory of mind obviously are going to play into this as well. But still, we do see that. So even biologically, if individuals are perhaps capable of reproduction by maybe, ages 13 to 15, it's not necessarily a good time to start. And in fact, we often get this idea that, non-industrial cultures, people will start having babies as soon as they can. It's like, actually, no. If we actually look at non-industrialized groups, that's not very common. In fact, if you look at things like hunter-gatherer groups, this tends to actually be delayed a bit longer, simply because with the low levels of, or threshold sort of existence of resources, it takes longer to gain enough energy for women, fat reserves for reproductive fat, before the body can actually start ovulating. So we definitely have delays there. If we look at other periods in history, yep, sorry.
I just have a question, how much of a problem is it back in the day, women attaining a certain level of fat?
Yeah. We don't know exactly, because we can't, that doesn't fossilize.
Yeah.
But comparing to modern hunter-gatherers, we know that food resources are not always easy to get. Looking at historical records, we know that food resources were not always easy to get. We do know historically, and from various archaeological evidence from fossils actually just are rocks. Bones of the minerals the cellular structure is mineralized, so that actually doesn't help us much. But in cases where, for example, we've got skeletal remains from, the 8 to 12,000 year ago period from people that were hunter-gatherers or early agrarians, there is actually some good evidence to suggest that the hunter-gatherers, at least in this early period, the beginnings of the agrarian period, hunter-gatherers were probably healthier than the stay-in-one-place agrarians. Because they had access to a wider range of foods. They'd follow game, they'd encounter different types of things that could be gathered, they'd move and nomadically migrate, and then, you know, go to different areas where different fruits were available seasonally. They wouldn't stay in one place. If you start planting food and you're growing wheat, well, that's what you got, wheat. You have a hard time getting all of your nutrients out of just wheat. It took a few thousand years before sort of that early agrarian system started to subdivide itself into an economics of scale there, where different people would supply different things, and economies and currencies and whatnot got going. So we can say at least in the early transition period, there's reasonable evidence to suggest that the agrarians, early agrarians, may not have been as healthy, but they probably actually had a more stable access to resources because they could plan for this. It wasn't so much at the vagaries of other weather patterns and other tribes and whatnot. But we do know that it takes a lot of energy for women, at least, to be able to successfully carry a baby to term. It requires a certain amount of reproductive fat stores. And these can be challenging to get under many hunter-gatherer situations. Now, again, we're dealing with modern hunter-gatherers who are not necessarily in the best environments, right? They've been displaced from better environments by people that have better technology. So this becomes a little bit of an extrapolation back in time, but the general feeling is that just if, you know, if perhaps menarche can occur at age 12, that may not have been the earliest point in time. This may have been, you know, now. May have been happening in the past. So it may have been a bit delayed. Here's another thing. We often say, oh, well, you know, birth control is a modern thing. Well, not really, actually. Lots of cultures practice all sorts of forms of birth control, from simple abstinence, which doesn't work all that well, to doing various other things instead of intercourse with respect to sex, to actually having a stunningly good idea of how the menstrual cycle works and being able to count days, which works okay up to a point. So, you know, there's very interesting issues there as well. Just because one is reproductively capable doesn't mean that one will, by necessity, be producing children. So, again, we tend to, as modern Western industrialized peoples that are so terribly impressed with our own cleverness and technology, tend to make these assumptions that those of our past ancestors who lacked all of our nice toys couldn't possibly have figured this sort of stuff out. There's some very interesting issues in anthropology, looking cultural anthropology, looking at non-industrialized medicine, so groups that are non-industrialized, looking at their medical knowledge, and a lot of it's based on correlations. They don't necessarily have the underlying causative structure, but at least correlationally, they've got systems that work not too badly. So, I don't know. Anyways, I think I cut off a hand that was going back up there. So, okay. All right. Anyway, so what we can say, at least, is compared to other primates, we've definitely got this extended childhood, and compared to other mammals, very extended childhood. So how does this adapt us? Well, life history theory, or life history theorists, the individuals that sort of approach the psychology in this way, argue that developmental processes should be seen as a way of actually maximizing an individual's inclusive fitness. So the stuff that happens during development, the individual child progressing to adulthood, is going to respond to environmental stimuli, respond to with respect to their own genetics in ways that will optimize his or her own inclusive fitness in the future. So again, if we take this back to the selfish gene, and we you know, put that greater goodism approach aside, and say, okay, what's going to work for this individual? I know we had a question about psychopathy earlier. Coming back into that later in the course, but just to put it here, I mean, you say, wow, psychopaths are horrible for the society. Yes, they are, but they're great for the psychopath, right? Psychopaths do very, very well for themselves. sucks to be the victim, but from the point of view of self-achieved inclusive fitness, it could work wonderfully. Just to, you know, keep you up at night, it seems like only about half of the psychopaths ever get caught. But to let you sleep, don't worry, the vast majority of them are not crazed serial killers. They're like car salesmen and, you know, corporate executives and lawyers and people running telephone scams. So you're not likely to be killed and eaten by one. But they may, you know, get some money out of you. Maybe a lot of money. All right. So life history theorists, unlike certain other branches of psychology, see development as an active process in which the individual is a participant in. So it's not passive stuff that just happens to the individual. Individuals will adjust their behavior based upon underlying genetics and environmental factors in a way that will ultimately be best for them. So keep that in mind. Now, we can talk about what's called the principle of allocation. So if you will, if we take sort of a page out of the human behavioral ecologist's book, we can talk about what's called somatic effort and reproductive effort. So somatic effort involves behaviors that are dealing with things like foraging, survival, learning, growth, all of this kind of stuff. Reproductive effort is mating, producing, rearing offspring. So somatic, it sort of breaks down as well within the kind of, if you think about this as well, you know, the natural selection, sexual selection, right? I mean, the somatic kind of parallels that natural selection of just how to stay alive. You know, staying alive. The reproductive effort goes to the sexual selection, that is reproducing, okay? So, but you're going to make trade-offs, right? The more energy time you put into reproductive effort, the less you're directing towards your somatic, right? Must find date for grad, okay? Running around trying to find someone to take with you to grad, trying to, you know, impress somebody, you know, in the tux, corsages, booking a limo, all this is a, yeah, did you remember to study for your exams, your finals? What? Oh, crap. Great, you got the date for grad, but you failed, so you don't actually graduate. But you still get to go to grad because you booked your tickets before you actually failed and have to come back for grade 12. Strikes me as stupid that graduations are before you actually know whether you've graduated, but I, of course, graduations from grade 1 also strike me as idiotic, but that's just me, my opinion, which is worth almost nothing, apparently. Trade-offs, all right? The more time you're spending putting into somatic efforts, you know, foraging, survival, all this kind of stuff, or, you know, working your way up the corporate ladder, you know, if you're not just doing the 9 to 5, but you're doing the 7 to 8, you know, 6 out of 7 days a week, yeah, your reproductive effort might be compromised there. Maybe you're not doing much in the way of dating. If you're in a relationship, maybe you're not spending very much time with that person. Maybe you're no longer in that relationship as a consequence. All right? Now, there is no, you might go, well, Dr. Snyder, how do I do it? How do I balance this? I should probably write a book on that. I get on Oprah. Oh, damn, too late. Well, there's still Dr. Phil. There's no single or unique, there's no one way to optimize the system. It depends very much on the individual's genetic predispositions and the local environment. Okay? Now, in terms of reproductive effort, let's talk about reproductive effort for a little bit here. Very broadly speaking, two techniques, two very broad approaches. The quantity approach, that is, have lots of offsprings, and because you've got more offspring, that means you're partitioning whatever resources you have into smaller amounts for each. So each offspring will have a more limited amount of resources invested into him or her. Second, you could go the quality route, have one or a few offspring, but put much more investment into those offspring. Environmental factors, environmental constraints are going to determine which strategy ultimately is going to be most successful here. There are male and female differences between this approach, obviously. And again, there's no single right way to do it. Now, if we look at this across species, and again, this is why humans are difficult, because we don't exist in just like a single narrow kind of environmental niche. Pros and cons to this. On the pro side of things, if you know the environment does change, global warming, for example, we're not going to go extinct just because of that, right? Whereas a penguin, which requires a particular chunk of, say, Arctic ice shelf, which is now melted and is gone, there goes that species. We're all over the place, right? We're pretty well able to get into all kinds of different environmental niches. So, you know, pros and cons there. But if we look at reproductive strategies across species, we often encounter two terms, an R-type species and a K-type species. R-type species produce as many offspring as possible. Most rodents, mice, many insectivores will do this, lagomorphs, so bunnies will do this, okay? Rabbits aren't actually rodents, but produce as many offspring as you can. But by doing that, you're putting relatively few resources into each one. So there's generally, I mean, insects, many insects, you know, oh, I just laid 1,000 eggs. Of course, if we're lucky, one will survive. There's going to be a high loss of those individuals, all right? A K-type species produces relatively few offspring. Often maybe just single births, like elephants, whales, or humans. We're actually much closer to the K-type strategy here. Now, keep in mind, R and K refer to species-type behaviors. We shouldn't use R and K types to talk about individuals. This is unfortunate because, in fact, much of the lay public does mess these up. Okay, and they get it wrong. Humans, as humans, regardless, it's like, oh, you know, K plus 8, doesn't that seem like an R-type strategy? Or the duffers that have like 19 kids and counting or something like this? Well, it looks like rabbits. No, as a species, we are much more on the K-type scale. I think we're more a K-type species. Okay, rodents and flies just out-reproduce us massively. What we can talk about within a species are using the term C and F. C for current, in other words, maximize your current fitness, or F, maximize future fitness. Now, a little bit different when you look at this from either the parent or the offspring's perspective. So, from parent's perspective, if the parent is following a C-type strategy, this would be, times are good, have as many children as possible right now. Don't know what the future is going to bring. I've got the resources. Do it now. Try to maximize my current direct fitness at this point in time. So that would be a C type. So even with being a K type species, right, if times are good, you get several children, you know, produced, and instead of, say, having an interbirth interval of 4 years, you drop this down to 1 and a bit years, okay. Right, that would be a C. So look at what you can do to maximize your current fitness. F works on maximizing the future fitness. Now, that might involve having fewer offspring, but investing more resources into each offspring. The environment is unstable. I've got one or two children. I could have more, but instead, I will save resources to give to these children that are adults for dowries or bride prices, or to buy land, or get them skills as a trade, which makes them essentially marketable commodities. If you want to talk about the economics of marriage, right? They've got something that makes them appealing, means they get access to better mates, which means, hopefully, long-term, better differential reproductive success. People don't actually think, well, actually some people do. It's interesting, if you actually go back and look into, say, late medieval and Renaissance periods, this is actually people that were writing at the time, very significant. What kind of trade could you get your children into? Who are you apprenticing them to? Would this be a good long-term career? Was this something that would be appealing to, you know, as marriage prospects? You actually see this much more if you've got arranged marriages, where parents really will think about it this way. Okay. Now, if you approach from the offspring's perspective, right, this may be a little bit, it's interesting, right? So let's say there's several children that have been born in the family. From an offspring's perspective, getting all the energy, the resources that individual can at this time may be very advantageous. Sharing with your siblings? Should you or shouldn't you? And the goals of a child may be in conflict with the goals of a parent. The child getting current resources is very significant. From an adult's point of view, the parent's point of view, having future fitness may be more significant. Now, in just about all of the learning theories that are out there, when we talk about learning, we talk about the value of learning is allowing individuals to make predictions about what's going to happen in the future, whether it's classical conditioning, so the CS has become associated with the US, which allows you to make predictions about what will happen in the presence of a conditional stimulus in the future, or in operant systems, in the presence of this discriminative stimulus, if I make a response, I've, based on past experience, come to expect this outcome. Regardless of how these work, generally learning theories look at the value of learning as making future predictions. And when we look at this in terms of child development, one of the arguments of life history theory is that this is really what's going on. This is a very significant aspect of childhood, is gaining experience to make predictions about what the future will bring. We'll talk about what I call attachment strategies in a little bit here, but so various types of attachment between children and parents. And these sort of childhood developed attachment patterns have influences on subsequent later adult behavior. The suggestion here that most, at least many, life history theorists make is that what childhood does, the childhood condition makes or acts as a model for the future. So whatever kind of experiences you're having as a child, you can use that to make predictions about what life is going to be like for you as an adult. Stability or instability of the future. Consider, if you grew up in a very stable environment, let's say parents stay together, access to resources is good, is relatively high throughout childhood. If that's been this hypothetical child's experiences, what should they predict about the future? The first 10, 12, 15 years of my life were stable, resources were available. I expect that the future is going to be that way. You have 15 years of data collected on this. On the other hand, what if you got a child from divorced parents, highly fluctuating access to resources, sometimes times are good, sometimes times are bad. What does that tell you about the future? Should you expect things to really change suddenly? Or is it going to be same old, same old? With respect then to trying to maximize, an individual trying to maximize future differential reproductive success here, if the expectation is for a stable future, so based on a stable childhood, if the expectation is for stable future, adopting an F-type strategy, a future fitness strategy, makes a lot of sense. If you expect stability, you can plan. Oh, sure, I have an opportunity to have a child now, but if I just wait for another couple years, my job will be better, I'll have more resources, I'll put a down payment, I'll be out of an apartment, into a condo, that's the better time to have the child. Yes, I've got enough resources right at this moment to support a child, but then I won't be able to get the condo. Perhaps in that case, if your expectation is for stability, wait. by the future. On the other hand, if your child's expectations, or the child's experiences, lead to an adult expectation of instability in terms of environment, resources, relationships, it's like, right, I can have a child right now. Is this the best time? I don't know. What was the future going to bring? I can't tell. I've got this chance right now to reproduce. I should take it. So current fitness, maximize current fitness. Yes, if I save some money, if I keep in my job, if the economy stays good, if I don't, if this relationship actually pans out, yeah, I could get a condo in another couple of years, maybe that'd be better. No way to predict that. My job is transitory, my relationships come and go, the environment, who knows, move around a lot. If that's the experience, reproduce now. Now may be the best time. You don't know what the future is going to bring. It could be even worse than it is right now. There's some interesting data that's come out with respect to things like, for example, the absence of a father in children's lives. Not specifically actually just a biological father, but let's say a strong male father role model. Could be stepfather, could be anything. Big brother, something like that. Okay. One of the things that, and again, these are correlation results. Obviously, for ethical reasons, you know, we can't take a whole bunch of families and go for ethical, you know, for ethical reasons. Right, we've randomly divided you into groups, and people in this group, yeah, the dads are just going away. And we're going to ensure that with a random forcible relocation program. And if you come back, we'll send assassins after you. They're highly trained death mice. Run on wheels constantly. You can't, right? So this is all correlational. We don't know the cause here, but here's what we know. Children that lack a strong male role model in their early childhood developmental period tend to have precocious sexual development. They will start having sex earlier, will have more partners. Boys become more aggressive, rebellious, and sexually exploitive as adults. Often misogynistic. Girls tend to have more negative attitudes towards sex, fewer long-term monogamous relationships as adults, perhaps serial relationships. Now, when we look at this in the case of, say, single mother families, do tend to be of lower socioeconomic, or have lower socioeconomics, so without a second adult they're assisting, lower socioeconomics, so lower resources, perhaps more unstable resources. What may happen here is, in cases without a father involved, the children adopt more current reproductive strategy to maximize their inclusive fitness. Their childhood has taught them that you aren't necessarily going to have good access, long-term access to resources. So what do we find? We find boys being more aggressive. Take what you can, when you can. How can you get it? Well, the easiest way, often for males, testosterone driven, not quite as good at theory of mind, Machiavellian intelligence perhaps, as women are, certainly less likely to negotiate, so be aggressive. Males, sexually exploitive. If you don't expect to have resources in the long run, actually invest into children, why bother? Have sex when you can. If a child is produced, don't invest in it. Deny parentage. Move on. The girls, okay, negative attitudes towards sex, the fewer long-term relationships. Don't expect, if you've learned, don't expect relationships to last. If things are getting difficult in a relationship, you could put the additional work into trying to maintain that relationship, but really, why? Past experience, even growing up and seeing what happened with your mother, has shown that it's not going to work in the long run anyway, so why waste the energy on that? Why try to do something long term? So the current reproductive strategies could be much more advantageous for these individuals. I mentioned attachment theory a few minutes back. If you've taken developmental psychology courses, I expect and actually hope that you've at least touched on issues of Baldy's and Belsky's attachment theories here. The primary names associated with modern attachment theory are John Bowlby, Mary Ainsworth, and Jake Belsky. There's various ways of testing for this, but the sort of standard diagnostic test of attachment is you have a parent, usually the mother, come in with the child. There's there for a little while. There's another, there's a stranger present. The child is given some stuffed toys and whatnot to play with. Mother leaves, and you see how much the child interacts with the stranger. Mom comes back a while later, and you see what the child does with respect to mom. Does the child rush over to mom? Does the child just sort of go, yeah, mom's back, and continue doing what the child was doing? Does the child seem to shun the mother as a punishment for having abandoned him or her with the stranger? So this is sort of, there's other ways of doing it, but this is one of the standard tests for attachment. And depending on how the criteria goes, children get can be categorized as either insecure, avoidant, secure attachment, or insecure, resistant. Now, there's different breakdowns in this, interestingly. Insecure, avoidant, about 25%. And when we take longitudinal studies, so children that are diagnosed insecure, avoidance, if we look at these children, follow them up into adulthood, they tend to have more short-term relationships. So fewer long-term relationships, more serial monogamy, if you will. Secure attachment children, about 65%, at least in, these percentages are coming out of like primarily North American, but Western developed countries, so the values may be different elsewhere. They tend to have, as adults, longer lasting, more stable relationships. Not always perfect, but generally more stable. Finally, there's this very small group, about 10% or less of the children, who are diagnosed as what's called insecure resistant. And they tend to have very high commitment to a small number of relationships, one or maybe a few relationships. But what's interesting is they tend to have fewer children. It's not entirely clear why. In part, I mean, because only 10% get diagnosed this way, smaller sample set here. But it may be that the individuals that are insecure resistant are putting so much effort and attention into the relationship that essentially the partner takes on sort of the attributions of the child. So you mother or father or parent the partner, as opposed to putting that effort into taking care of children. It might involve managing someone's career, their job, taking care of them, coddling them, what have you. It's not that they won't have children, they certainly will, but fortunately they tend to be less focused on than their own children or their own reproduction, and more on the relationships in their life. Now, if we look at it just this way, so the insecure, avoidant, insecure, resistant, on the surface, this seems fairly maladaptive, right? It's like, wow, you know, a bunch of short-term relationships or not highly reproductively successful long-term relationships. Like, that doesn't seem quite, I mean, you'd think short-term relationships may not be great, right? Is the stability good? But there's a possibility here that these are actually optimal depending upon, you know, very different life history environments. So the experiences growing up. So different attachment styles, which are acquired during these early years of development then. Again, if we look at this from plan for the future, this may allow the child as an adult, or leading towards adulthood, to make predictions about what the future brings. So if you're in insecure avoidance there and have more short-term relations, well, again, that may be a perfectly valid attempt at optimization from a current fitness approach. Go from relationship to relationship. You're in a relationship. Okay, so this individual seems to have good qualities, good genes, good current resources. reproducible. Oh, look, there's somebody even hotter that's come along. Time to trade up. Well, why not? If everything is short-term anyway, if the environment's going to be unstable, if you can't plan for the future, if you got that opportunity to get something better, why wouldn't you? Work by Belsky shows that secure attachment children tend to come out of environments that are stable during the early developmental period. So low marital stress, access to relatively ready access to resources, consistent parenting, so exposure to consistent patterns of rules and whatnot. So the children have through perhaps exposure to their parenting, the style of parenting of their parents, have shown that what is valued here is parenting over reproduction. So they've come to learn that you maximize your quality over your quantity. They're adopting a future approach. So that early stability leads to a prediction of stability in the future. So you follow this. The insecure, avoidant individuals, Belsky's found, come out of child's environments where the resource availability is low or inconsistent, and often parental attention is irregular, inconsistent, or sometimes even unwilling. So these are children the parents don't actually want to engage with. It may not be necessarily the parents' fault. I mean, this could be... depending on the environment, the economics, the background of the parent, having to work several jobs. So just not being being able to be around. The parent may actually want to invest in the job, but because of necessities of a modern industrialized world, may not be able to. So there's possibilities there. In any case, it seems that perhaps what the children are learning here is the instability, and you favor reproduction over parenting. Belsky has also found that in these cases here, there's often a higher number of children in the family with a shorter interbirth interval between them. Not always from different partners, but not uncommonly. So stepchildren, or pardon me, half siblings, is not uncommon in this pattern. Finally, we get the insecure resistance. Now, again, there's not very many people that are categorized this way, so Belsky's interpretations on this are a little bit speculative. He suggests that it could be that the parents are unable to contribute to the child for some reason, either due to some sort of psychological makeup, issues of how they were raised, not having much parental investment when they were a child, maybe stable, you know, perhaps stable environment, but cold parents, if you will, that weren't in invested. He doesn't have a really great explanation for this at this point here, but he suggests that what may be acquired by these children is that focusing on direct fitness is not the way to go. Instead, look for gaining inclusive fitness. So maybe aunts or uncles that may, you know, not have children of their own, but will invest in nieces and nephews to some extent or assist. You know, we do see this in other species as well. There are males and females that don't reproduce themselves, but primarily females. Males and a few species other than humans do this, but females will then assist with their sisters' offspring. So there's a possibility here.
Graduate school.
Project. PhD. You know, work that could be done definitely on the insecure resistance individuals within this life history approach, and contextualizing it with an evolutionary psychology framework could be very interesting work to do there. So a lot of stuff happening in the early years of development. And I'm reluctant to suggest that what happens in the first few years of life is like an imprinting process. because imprinting implies there's a very strong biological predisposition to acquire certain things, like Conrad Lorenz's geese that, you know, hatch out and boom, look at Lorenz and go, "Mom," and treat the first big thing that moves around as you know, their mother, and then follow Lorenz around as he wanders about through the farm and ignore other geese. So I'm reluctant to suggest that the attachment process is imprinting in the same sense, and that, I mean, the geese are very biologically predisposed to do this, okay, this thing. But what I can say here is that in terms of things like observational learning, this is massive in children. We talked a little bit about mirror neurons, I think. So the idea that it's specific parts of your brain that learn by observing, a huge amount has happened. Anybody that does study anything about language acquisition, I guess, is huge, you know, massive during the first few years of life there, first up to maybe say eight, nine years of age, massive acquisition of language, and a lot of it's being done simply by observing, listening, picking up patterns from others. Children are, if you will, observational sponges. You don't have to teach children to learn by observing. They just do it. We're very strongly evolved this way. So depending upon the kind of environmental experiences that children have in those, you know, early years of childhood, the home life, not surprised. I mean, you know, you look at the sort of, you know, sad cases of children who were abused themselves as children, more often, there's a higher chance that they will grow up to be abusive parents. It's what you're exposed to. So, behavior modifiers have to deal with that a lot, you know, trying to change the conditioning that was established, not even intentionally, but just through observation. If not child, not abusing children, could be a spouse abuse. If a child comes out of a house where spousal abuse is common, more likely to engage in spousal abuse him or herself. So again, the observational process there. So you look at that, yeah, the first 8-10 years of kids' existence could be massively significant just through, and I'm not saying this is necessarily, right, an evolved adaptation for children to assess environment, right? This could be a process of just observational learning in general. Okay, so it could be a byproduct, not necessarily a module there for assess environment with respect to attachment and future reproductive success. That'd be a pretty specific cognitive module. But if there's a much broader observational learning system in place, which there is, we know that, then, you know, picking up this information is a byproduct of another existing system there. Okay. I've mentioned already that there's this interaction between genes and environment. One of the questions that really some people are focused on is just how much of genetics is, or how much of development is genetically regulated? In other words, the heritable component to this. For some researchers and some individuals, this is a really, really big thing. It's actually a really hard question to answer. Right? Because, I mean, what aspects of development are we really going to focus in on? So this becomes hard. Well, we do know that the environment does interact with the genome. These developmental transition points, you know, regardless of whose stage theory you utilize, there's flexibility in there. Okay? It could come from the genes, it could come from the environment. But exactly how much, what extent, when, it's not really well defined. What aspects of the environment are really significant for particular types of development as well? And again, when? These are the kinds of questions. Now, these questions are not generally addressed by evolutionary psychologists. We know about them. Pay a bit of attention to them there. But it's not the main focus, because again, evolutionary psychologists are more interested in issues of our behaviors, characteristics, attributes, adaptive or non-adaptive, how could that have been selected for or against. The actual mechanics of how much is genes, how much is environment, and specifically what genes are much less interesting. Look at it this way. Darwin came up with an entire theory of evolution without knowing anything about modern genetics. Few quibbles aside about particulars that he had in there, Darwin's evolutionary theory has held up pretty well over the last 150 years. Yeah, some details have changed, but I mean, his basic elements are right. You don't need specific genetic knowledge to do this. But this is what the field of behavioral genetics does. And it's a fascinating field. For the last 4 years, I've taught a course in behavioral genetics. I won't be doing that. Dr. Pete Hurd's going to take it over. If you've got other courses, Psychology 372, Dr. Hurd's going to be teaching that one this winter term. He actually does behavioral, works in behavioral genetics of aggression, as it turns out. So, good guy. If you're looking for a course to take, definitely worth considering that. But what behavioral geneticists do is try to look at these gene-environment interactions with respect to specific behaviors. If you will, this is the nature-nurture issue, and this is what goes back to Francis Galton, who we talked about back at the beginning of the course. Various ways to do this, I mean, monozygotic, dizygotic, twins, biological siblings, adopted siblings, look at differences, similarities between the behaviors here. Look at, again, whether they're similar or different genetics, similar or different environments. What's the variation of behavior? So there's a whole field that does this. And it's worth, if you're going to work in the area of evolutionary psychology, to be somewhat conversant in the details of behavioral genetics, but you don't have to become, you know, an expert here. Just based on studies of identical twins, in terms of developmental progress here, it seems that genes account for maybe 40 to 50% of the variability in behavior, and environment maybe 50 to 60%. Now, we can divide this environmental component up into what's called the shared environment and the non-shared, or sometimes called unique environment. The sort of traditional idea of shared environment is the shared environment represents factors that are common to all siblings in a family. Now, the traditional approach to this, which incidentally is being reconsidered in modern behavioral genetics, is that anything that would happen to the entire family should be counted as a shared environment. So if parents get divorced, all, you know, we should see that as a shared environmental effect on the children. But here's the kicker, right? The age of the child might make a very big difference in terms of this. The sex of a child might make a difference. The extent to which the child has other peer networks can make a difference in terms of coping with divorce parents. So there's more recent re-examination of, should we treat everything that happens to children in the same family as being shared environment? Oh, the kids all went to the same school. Okay, did they have different teachers? Oh, right? It might be fine if, you know, there's only one grade four teacher and every kid gets that. But what if the teacher's, you know, going through some big life event 1 year and her teaching of a grade four class in 1 year is somewhat different than in the subsequent year? So, again, these become an issue. But the problem is these are really difficult things to pull out in a study to try to analyze those. So the more traditional approach of this to trying to quantify environment was just to describe things as either shared or unique. Now, the unique environment are supposed to be factors that are specific to an individual. One child takes band, one child gets into soccer. Okay, those would be seen as unique factors there. Now, using these sort of more traditional values here, of the maybe 50 to 60% then of environmental involvement in terms of behavior, some studies have shown that perhaps shared environmental effects factors are maybe only up to 10%, contributing only to about 10% of this. The other 40 to 50% are coming in from the unique environmental side of things. So our unique environment or non-shared environment could be a lot of other stuff here. I mean, sickness, specific teachers. Here's an interesting one, in utero environment. Okay. Birth order can play a difference here. Child's development, whether you're a first child or a fourth child, mom's uterus, things change with mom's physiology. Differences between, you say, well, what about twins? Okay, you got twins, they're both in the same uterus at the same time. It's not entirely the same thing. Placental placement becomes really significant then. Depending on the placement of the placenta, one twin, they could be getting much better nutrients resources than the other twin. So, you know, these are some issues with the non-shared environment here. So broadly, just experience that one child has, but his or her siblings don't. Now, as some studies are suggesting that out of this environmental component, the bulk of what's significant here is the unique environmental effects. And a good deal of this is derived from work by Judith Harris, who has proposed what she calls a group socialization theory. Harris argues that the most important thing for children is not their family, but their peers, so other children, if you will. She's arguing that the reason that the group environment, the reason that the non-shared environment, the unique environment, is accounting for so much of the variance in behavior in children is because children have different peer groups. And so, yes, they are in family, they have the same parents, but what's really more important to children, she argues, is peers. She's primarily written about this in book form as opposed to articles, interestingly enough. So we're going to talk about group socialization theory for a few minutes here. Interestingly, so the APA has come out with, you know, over the years, you know, lots of groups do this, you know, like top 100 books of the century in nuclear physics or psychology or whatever. And Harris's work has been cited in the perhaps top 100 most significant should-read books of the 20th century for developmental psychology. Now, that doesn't mean it's because necessarily everyone thinks it's right. Okay, I mean, significant just means if you're going to work in the field, you should read this. If you're going to work in the field of, say, autism, I mean, reading Wakefield studies where he's argued that vaccination causes, especially his discredited studies about this, if you're going to work in the field, you should read them. They're significant. They're not scientifically right, but to understand how things work in the public sphere, you need to read it. Now, I'm not saying that we should say, oh, Harris's work is like Wakefield's there, just scientifically bad, but this is what I mean. Just because it's on the top, you know, should read list doesn't necessarily, we'll get back to this. So, to sort of compress Harris's work of a couple of books here down into a very small nutshell, she suggests that peers serve as better role models for children than parents. And she argues that this is because parents, or adults in general, be they teachers, coaches, whatnot, provide actually very little day-to-day useful guidance or control over the socialization development. She's doing most of this work, I should say, in terms of Western industrialized groups. A lot of this data is coming out of stuff from the UK. She's doing a lot of this looking at a lot of correlational data going through the 20th century, where especially post-World War II in the UK, we start to see increasing from various surveys, questionnaires, and whatnot have been done over the years following the 1940s, the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, seeing increasing reports of peer groups, cohorts of children growing up to adults, identifying less and less with their parental generation. So seeing increasing differences, self-reported increased differences in perspective between themselves and their parents' generation. How much weight should really be placed on these is a very interesting question. The economics of pre-World War II Europe, and North America for that matter, and post, are very different. We've shifted from a much more rural, I know it seems a little odd in Alberta where rural still seems huge, but we've actually shifted from a much more rural form of existence into a heavily urbanized. And in fact, there's some very interesting work that's been coming out over the last few years looking at actually how this was a planned, intentionally socially governed process where governments, Western governments, have in fact acted to move people out of the rural environments and into urban centers. Some of this goes back to the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, with the expectation that what you need is a relatively cheap workforce to do industrialized labor jobs. And so if you're out there on the farms, you're not working in a factory. So looking at things like UN and documentation and whatnot, there's some people that are arguing that this was in some way, and they're not suggesting it's some sort of Illuminati secret organization doing this, but at the time, governments looked and said, where's the future going? The future is going into industrialization in the first world, get people out of this. Now, once that happens, you know, in terms of, so looking at 50s, 60s, 70s, yeah, you're going to get a very different view of, are you similar to your parents' generation or not? If your parents were living in the farm and you're living in, you know, Manchester, a heavily industrialized town, which incidentally led to the Beatles, where I was born, as it turns out, very different approach. So again, how, you know, the kind of, these are correlational data that Harris has used primarily, so one has to be somewhat careful. Yeah?
Yeah, cultural disconnect, because it's a technological revolution. The culture of the 70s, the culture of the 60s,
yeah,
is very, very
different. Sure, definitely,
it increases as technology increases.
Sure. Sure, sure, no question. And I mean, yeah, our structure, I mean, you know, these things, right? Almost everyone's got some sort of phone, if not social media through electronics. People have withdrawal symptoms if you take their electronic gizmos away from them, especially people of your generation. Danish study recently showed they go through withdrawal. If I take this stuff away from you, if I take your phones and your computers and your PlayStations, I take them away from you, you'll get the shakes. Not all of you. Maybe about 70% of you will start craving something, even if it's like old Donkey Kong or whatnot. Remember Donkey Kong? No, too young? Yeah. Anyways, yeah, definitely. There's a lot of factors that are involved in this. And again, this is one of these questions that, so given that Harris is using primarily correlational, non-experimental data, what's the causative process? So there could be a lot of confounding factors and variables here. So anyways, but so here's her idea. She says, here's the idea, that peer groups are more important. So in other words, she says, when it comes down to imitation or observational learning, who should you imitate? Who should you pay attention to? Well, Harris says you should imitate the young, not the old. You should imitate your generation, not your older, not your parents' generation. Here's some of her reasons. She says, well, youth. The youth are innovators. Cultural innovation can increase fitness. If you come up with a new way of doing something, if it works, super. Where does that innovation often come from? The new generation. They approach things differently. Imitating peers over parents, then, could increase behavioral variability in a culture. Right? So if you just do, well, this she sort of extrapolates from our idea of homogeneity versus heterogeneity, the value of sexual reproduction in terms of mixing the genes up such that, you know, a parasite gets in to the area that can target all the asexually reproducing individuals. So she says here, if your culture is sort of monolithic and everyone's the same, that seems to be a culture ripe for extinction. But if you innovate, if you don't do what your parents did, but you do something else, right? So instead of just doing what the parents did, you do something different, that puts variability into the culture, so that culture should survive, right? Variability is good. Okay. parents may not always be around. They may, your parents may divorce, they may take off, they may abandon you, they may be eaten by something. They may die. Back in the EEA, parents, you know, probably got eaten by stuff or killed in a landslide or drowned trying to save some other kid or something like this. A peer group is always going to be there. I mean, an individual child, if you've got a, you know, your posse of 20 kids, oh, sure, a few of them are going to be eaten by something back in the EEA or die from some disease or, you know, whatever it happens to be. But new kids will come in, so you've always got a peer group there. You may not always have your parents. Finally, parents and children often are going to have competing interests. I mean, you know, Trivers has got his paper on parental investment and how what the parent wants and what the child wants, competition for resources. We've talked about that in terms of sexual selection there, so there could be issues there. So these are the kinds of things that Harris used. And she's contextualized many of these in what, at least on the surface, looks to be an evolutionary psychology framework. Her first book's coming up in 95 on this. This is a few years after Cosmites and Tooby come up with Adapted Mind. This is as evolutionary psych is starting to make a big splash. So what Harris is arguing here is that these are actually evolved systems. These are adaptive systems. Having your peer group being most important makes sense, she says, from this evolutionary perspective. But she's got some things stunningly wrong. First off, it's the individual, not the culture, that's the level of selection. We've talked a little bit about multi-level selection here. This is still a somewhat contentious issue. But even so here, it's the individual that reproduces or doesn't. If an individual is an innovator, if that benefits the individual, woohoo, score. The individual will probably reap the rewards of that and be more differentially reproductively successful. Society may not. The culture may not. Okay, so it's not a given. But hey, there's been some incredibly stagnant cultures that have survived for hundreds and hundreds of years without much in the way of innovation. It's not a given. Again, it's not the culture that reproduces. Imitating peers or parents increases behavioral variability in the culture. Well, again, culture is not the level of selection. So the sort of paralleling analogy to the idea of a good genes interpretation and variation in offspring and parasite resistance, or the Red Queen hypothesis, again, doesn't really work here. She's taken an idea that does work and boom, jumped it up to a level of culture. And it's not necessarily a good fit. You can make that argument, but you probably shouldn't try to say then this is an evolutionarily evolved system because of this. Parasite-host interactions are not necessarily the same thing as culture interactions. In fact, we go back to even our work with eugenics and other concerns about social Darwinism, right? I mean, again, this were some of the issues here. Social Darwinism was attempting to jump to the culture level, you know, take these evolutionary processes that can individuals, skip it up, and treat a culture as if it is an individual. And again, there's issues with that. The idea parents may not always be around, peer groups always are. Okay, let's look at it this way. Back in the EEA, if your parents get eaten by something or are gone or you're abandoned, you've got bigger problems than not having a parental role model right there. Okay? You're probably going to starve and die. And your posse of 8-year-old friends, they're not going to keep you alive. Because who's keeping them alive? Their parents. It's not an issue of, gosh, mom and dad are gone. Who will I learn my cultural rules from? Oh, I can learn that from my peers. Sure, but then you die in a few weeks from starvation. You go, wait, isn't somebody else going to feed the kid? Not necessarily. Won't somebody else in the tribe take the child in? Maybe, if there's a relative. We know from studies that, I mean, we say now, well, look, you know, we adopt kids that we're not related to at all. It's pretty common. People are going off to third world countries. Not enough babies to adopt. Let's get them from other countries. Let's adopt them in. Deal with the morality of that in some other setting, probably over beer. But it's like, this is recent. If you either look at historical records or you look at non-industrialized, more traditional, whether or not they're hunter-gatherer groups, you find the children that are adopted are generally adopted by family members, by extended family. If you do not have extended family to take them in, they don't get adopted. Okay? They say, well, okay, back in the EA, you probably had tribal groups, extended family. Yep. But here's the kicker. You're closer to a threshold of existence, resource threshold. You know, you have your own kids that you're just able to keep alive with maybe a little bit extra so that maybe you can have another kid. And then your nephew gets orphaned. Well, think about this. What's the R value between you and your nephew? What's the R value between you and your kids and any future kids? If you're at threshold for resources, adopting niece or nephew, or maybe even a more distant relative over your own kids or future kids, is that good? From a different reproductive success perspective, no, it's not. Last one here. Parents and children often have competing interests. Have you ever actually been around kids? So do children. I want to play this game. No, we're playing this game. I want to be in charge. No, I'm in charge. I want to hide. No, you're seeking. I'm going to hit you with this rock. Not if I hit you with this rock first. I know it sounds mostly with boys, but girls do the same thing, just in a more complicated social sort of way. So the argument is like, well, you know, parents and children have competing interests for things, but so do kids. Look at it this way. You know, let's go back to the Tangled Bank interpretation, right? Who are you competing with? For, let's even say things like access to mates. I mean, I know, this shows up on Maury and, you know, and Montel all the time. My mom took my boyfriend. Okay. I mean, we've got a biased sample set here, right? You know? But reality, who's likely to take your girlfriend or your boyfriend? One of your friends. Somebody in your peer group, right? Keep your friends close and your enemies closer. Think Machiavellian on this one here. Who's going to steal your partner? Someone like you. Your dad's probably not going to show up on campus and, you know, swipe your girlfriend, or your mom's not going to show up and swipe. Well, I mean, it could happen. I don't know what your families are like. It's possible. But it's much less likely. So who are you really competing? Who are you competing with for a job once you get out of university? Whoa, mom took my job. I didn't even know she was applying for that. No, it's your peers. So, I mean, Harris's things sound reasonable. They sound on the surface very evolutionary. But if you look at it a bit more, you got to say, and I'm not saying that she's into, I'm not saying the peers aren't important. I'm just saying that the idea that we've evolved to focus more on using peers for learning, for judging the future, as opposed to adults, kind of hard to, some issues, let's just say issues. Okay. We're done for the day, so we'll see you, next week, yeah.